Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And coming up, we'll look at what the University of Colorado is doing to combat sexual assault on campus.
But first, at this moment, millions of Scots are heading to vote yes or no on independence from the United Kingdom. The final polling shows the yes vote just a few points behind the no, a statistical tie. And this could be a record turnout. 97% of Scotland's eligible voting population has registered, and that includes 16 and 17-year-olds who have been given the right to vote for the first time for this referendum. Rich Preston is covering the story for NPR in Edinburgh, where the final votes will be hand-tallied tonight. Rich, what has it been like there?
We woke up to a grey morning in Edinburgh today, but other parts of the country are enjoying sunshine. Regardless of the weather, though, the atmosphere is electric. Some people feel like they've waited their whole lives for this vote. Ari Shapiro and I hit the streets this morning. There's a real buzz in the atmosphere, people wearing buttons, people waving flags, people wearing their kilts. And regardless of how they're voting, there's really the sense that this is the future of a new Scotland.
Well, either way, it is. And tell us about the process. We know there are 5,000 polling stations. Tell us more about the vote.
Yeah, there are over 5,000. There are 5,579 polling stations across Scotland. They open up at 7 in the morning and they're open until 10 o'clock tonight. When the polls close, the boxes are taken to one of 32 local authority areas across the country. Now, in some cases, like the Highlands and Islands, that includes transporting them by helicopter and boat. As you said in your introduction, 97% of the electorate have registered to vote and the turnout is expected to be high, well over 80%.
Well, and we are hearing that these votes will be counted by hand. Now, when you say 80% of the electorate, how many people are we talking about there? And counting by hand, tell us more about that.
Well, 97% of the electorate have registered. That's 4.2 million, over 4.2 million people. So, as you say, 80% of those are expected to turn out, if not more. They go to the polling booths, they cast their vote, and those voting slips are taken to the local authority areas. They're then counted in those areas and the details sent to Edinburgh for confirmation. And that's the point where people can ask for a recount. That's what might hold the vote up. But when Edinburgh and each local authority are happy with the numbers, they get confirmed and read out through the night. There'll be a busy period, probably about midnight, one in the morning, and it will go steadily through the night until the last few trickle in at around 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock Friday morning. That means that it's around breakfast time on Friday that the complete result of the referendum, and therefore the future of Scotland and the United Kingdom, will be known. What's interesting is there's a small quirk of law which means that whatever result the chief counting officer, a woman called Mary Pitcaithley, declares is legally binding, even if she reads the wrong result. But she's assured everyone that that won't happen.
I'm sure she'll be very careful as she does that. So Rich Preston there in Edinburgh, what's it been like to cover this story for you?
It's been terrific to cover the build-up to the story, but what's interesting is the actual polling day itself. Because contrary to the United States, where you have the First Amendment, there are very strict reporting restrictions in Britain on a polling day. It doesn't matter whether it's a referendum or a European election. You're really, really tightly bound by what you can say, which means broadcasters, journalists, reporters aren't allowed to report anything that might sway anyone's vote whatsoever. There's no reference to campaign material, no interview with politicians, spokespeople, party leaders. All you get are basic facts, what the weather's doing, what so-and-so is wearing. So it's quite interesting that after all the noise of the past few months, there's this strange silence descends. There's very little in the media. People go into that small booth, pull a curtain behind them, and mark their slip.
Yeah. We're hearing from a colleague that she went to the Scottish Times, the paper, to just see what's going on. And you can't read the editorials on the vote. They've blocked that because, again, they don't, by law, they don't want to at all influence the vote. And she said she could read articles from back in the 1970s, but that was about it. But speaking of which, journalists from around the world are there. What have they been saying about covering this?
The interest really has gone global. especially from areas like Spain. There's a lot of Spanish journalists here because there's interest in Catalonia and Madrid about how this might impact on politics in their country. But there are Australian reporters, American reporters, obviously lots of British reporters. There's a big interest in this story.
Sure. Countries that have populations that would also like to break away are watching very, very closely. Rich Preston, covering the independence referendum for NPR in Scotland, there in Edinburgh. Rich, thank you.
Thanks, Robin. Great to talk to you.
Well, here in this country, the University of California has unveiled recommendations for a new plan to curb sexual misconduct on campus. All students, faculty, and staff would have to go through special training. UC President Janet Napolitano announced the plan yesterday, and it comes as more than 70 public and private colleges and universities are under federal investigation for possibly not doing enough to protect students from sexual assault. The University of Colorado Boulder is one of the schools on that list, and it has responded by adding new awareness programs for all incoming students. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Colorado Public Radio's Jenny Brundine reports.
Freshman Maddie Hershire has already had her first close call. It was the first time she used alcohol in high school.
There was a guy there, he was getting kind of touchy-feely, and I wasn't really all the way coherent, obviously, because I had a lot to drink, but my friend was there, and she was sober. When he actually tried to make a move to start something, she told him, like, all right, buddy, we're going to go home. Please don't touch my friend anymore. And he kind of got angry, but then she just pulled me away from the situation and put me in the car and tucked me in.
Nationally, on average, 90% of campus sexual assaults involve alcohol, according to a study for the National Institute of Justice. Hershire is older, more aware, and much more careful now, but still worries about sexual assault. Some students aren't fully aware of the dangers, so freshmen must attend three comprehensive orientations on everything from what sexual consent really means to how to stealthily and safely intervene when a boyfriend may be verbally abusing his girlfriend. These freshmen have just come out of an orientation session on how to be more alert as a bystander at, say, a party. Many students say they already have strategies for watching out for their friends. Miles McMahon talks about helping his female friends who've drunk too much.
They're usually puking their brains out, so you gotta help them hold their hair and stuff. So just make sure no stranger's trying to come up and take advantage of them. Just do what you're supposed to do.
And that's the kind of awareness officials at the University of Colorado Boulder are trying to build. They know they can't eliminate drinking on campus, but they're hoping to make all students become more alert to sexual assault, partner abuse, and sexual harassment. CU Boulder came into the spotlight last year after a sexual assault case sparked a yet-to-be-completed federal investigation. That landed the school on a list this year of more than 70 colleges under scrutiny. Last summer, the school commissioned its own external review. It found the school is following federal law.
But our job is to go beyond that. Our job is to be higher than that and to put best practices in place.
That's Valerie Simons, the school's new Title IX coordinator. Title IX sets rules for how colleges should handle allegations of sexual assault and harassment. Simons is examining every layer of the school's practices. Already, she's combining two offices that investigate student and staff misconduct. And on the education side, Simons wants more than freshman training. She'd like to go into the dorms, where students live, work, and study, to do more intensive training that's based on real experiences.
How do we take it to the next level, and how do we get it sustained throughout the year so we can keep those skills current?
Hey, bros.
In another orientation session, students watch a YouTube video of a young male. He tells viewers the girl on the couch behind him is passed out.
Guess what I'm going to do to her?
You feel dread at what's about to happen next, but he tucks her in with a blanket, sets a glass of water next to her, and says to the camera,
"Real men treat women with respect."
Yeah!
The students clap. On the surface, it seems pretty simple. Yes to sex or no to sex. But when you have alcohol and young people who aren't confident about talking about sex, plus peer pressure, it's a dangerous mix. And some freshmen seem fuzzy about the concept of consent. Grant McMullen is new to campus, but he knows the drinking scene. He says some guys see girls as targets.
Guys definitely want to bring the girls to the house and get them drunk. Like, it's just kind of a thing. They go with it most of the time.
McMullen says it's just to have fun, but it usually ends in sex.
Because, like, sometimes they, like, give off you know, some body language that you'd think they'd want it, and then they're drunk, so they just go with it. So, like, I don't know, maybe they really don't.
For some guys, he says, it's a confusing situation.
Because you're definitely tempted. I mean, if they don't reject you, that's kind of their, their fault.
In fact, it's not their fault, says Jessica Ladd-Weber with the University of Colorado Boulder's Office of Victim Assistance, which has been on the campus for more than two decades. The honor code is clear. Silence by itself cannot be interpreted as consent. It is voluntary, mutually understandable words which indicate both parties want to participate in sexual activity.
And that when people are fearful or being coerced or threatened, that they don't have the free will to give consent. And also that if someone is too intoxicated due to drugs and or alcohol, that they do not have the capacity to give consent either.
18-year-old Carson Good, a freshman, says whenever possible, talk about sexual boundaries before drinking.
When they're sober, you maybe come up with an agreement that what they do want to do tonight and what they don't want to do tonight, and that you live by those standards and you don't let people do something that they wouldn't make the decision of sober.
And sometimes, says Jessica Ladd-Weber of the Office of Victim Assistance, a student can be uncomfortable communicating what she really feels. The school's health office developed posters and magnets that say just because they aren't saying no, 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 doesn't mean they're saying yes, yes, yes. She says they've proved popular.
I think they validate people, men and women, in like, that's what I think. I just don't know how to say it. Now I have a poster to be like, that's how I feel. I'm going to hang this poster in my room. Some people steal these posters to hang them in their room because they think they're so powerful. I've had people come in here and say, I'm going to take that poster and hang it because it's how I want to say it. I just don't know how.
Title IX coordinator Valerie Simons plans to track whether what students learn in orientations translates into practice as the school year moves forward.
Because any program is only going to be measured about how effective it is. I mean, we have to be able to say, we are preventing this. What are we doing?
Meantime, the federal investigation into how the Boulder campus handles allegations of sexual assault and harassment continues. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Brundine.
And let's get to our weekly Senate tracker. This week we're focusing on Louisiana, where Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu is fighting to keep her job. Joining us now is Sue Lincoln of WRKF in Baton Rouge. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And we should explain, first of all, that it is a little different in Louisiana. There are not just the two main candidates in this race because there is what's called a jungle primary. Explain what that is and what that means for the race.
In the jungle primary, which in federal elections is scheduled on Federal Election Day, every candidate runs against every other candidate. In the U.S. Senate race here in Louisiana, there are nine qualified candidates for the race. Five are Democrats, three are Republicans, one is a Libertarian. The front runners in the race are obviously the incumbent, Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu, and Republican Congressman Bill Cassidy.
Okay, and let's talk about these candidates. And we're going to get to, there's one other one who is making some waves in this race. We'll talk about him as well. But first of all, to Mary Landrieu, who's been in office for 18 years. Here she is speaking on WDSU News in New Orleans, where she touted her position as chair of the Senate Energy Committee.
Now that I am the chair and have this clout for the people of Louisiana, I'm running for re-election to use that on behalf of creating jobs and hope and opportunity here. Why would we want to throw this clout away when that committee is so important, so essential to the economic growth of our state?
It's interesting that we're hearing that from her because we've been hearing that kind of thing from incumbents all around the country. Why would you want to give up this clout? How else is Landrieu positioning herself in this race?
Well, she is known as a blue dog Democrat. That is one of the Democrats that is more moderate, more fiscally conservative. She's always been a blue dog Democrat. She is trying to be as middle of the road as possible, whereas the other side, the Republicans who are seeking to unseat her in order to change the U.S. Senate control to Republican, are tarring her, if you will, with the fact that she is a Democrat and that she supports the president.
And it has been brought up that she improperly billed her Senate office for around $40,000 in charter flight costs that should have been paid by her campaign. Has that been a big issue?
It has been a big issue by the Louisiana Republican Party, but it doesn't seem to be resonating much with voters as being a problem because she has reimbursed the government for that money.
Okay, let's get to her closest opponent, Congressman Bill Cassidy, who has represented Louisiana's 6th district since 2009. Here's a recent campaign video from him.
But if elected, I will work and vote to balance the federal budget, supporting a balanced budget amendment so that government lives within its means, as does the typical Louisiana family. I will fight wasteful spending of our tax dollars. I will protect our Second Amendment rights. I will promote and protect life.
Tell us more about Bill Cassidy.
Well, Bill Cassidy is a member of the House Tea Party Caucus, though he doesn't actually identify as a Tea Party candidate. He serves in the House on the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And as you said earlier, he has served 3 terms, 6 years as opposed to Landrieu's 18 years in Congress.
And he is a doctor. He was criticized earlier this year for describing the uninsured as relatively less sophisticated, less comfortable with forms, less educated, saying that they would have a hard time signing up for Obamacare. He later clarified that comment, saying there are educated people without insurance. But has that been a problem for him?
Not really. He is heavily supported by the medical industry. He has taught in the LSU medical education system. And as such, he has worked in Louisiana's charity hospital system. So he has been in contact throughout his career, aside from politics, with folks who did not have insurance. I mean, it's understandable where he's coming from. But he's part of this new phenomenon we're seeing, and Louisiana is kind of on the forefront of this, of being doctors who are also politicians. We currently have 3 members of Congress in our 6-man congressional delegation who are physicians in addition to being members of Congress.
And there is another candidate, as we said, another Republican candidate who is gaining some traction and will play a role in this race. And that would be Rob Manis, who's a retired Air Force colonel. He's polling 3rd currently. Tell us about him.
After he retired from the Air Force, he moved to Louisiana to work for Entergy, which is the equivalent of Edison Company, a power company down here. And he's been making a name for himself by claiming to be one of us, is his campaign slogan. He is decidedly connected with the Tea Party. And most voters are looking at him as kind of what we would have called at one time a carpetbagger because he didn't grow up here. He's never lived here before his retirement from the Air Force. But he is pulling some people, especially those who are concerned about the state of the United States military. He's pulling them into his camp.
Now, I see a story today on NOLA.com saying that Mary Landrieu is hoping to benefit from turnout because the Democrats are running some candidates in races that they have very little chance of winning, perhaps just to turn out votes for Mary Landrieu. What are the polls saying in this race?
Right now, the latest polls that we've got are showing that Cassidy would pull down 44% of the vote, Landrieu 41% of the vote, with 6% undecided. That gives Cassidy a +3 for those of you who are statisticians. But realistically, that doesn't take into account all the other candidates who are going to siphon off some votes. We think it will be Cassidy versus Landrieu on November 4th as the top vote getters in this 9-candidate field, which means we're going to see some headbutting over the next month till we get to our December 6th actual runoff.
All right. So a Louisiana Senate race that could go well past Election Day. Sue Lincoln of WRKF in Baton Rouge, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The U.S. Senate is expected to vote today on that spending bill that includes President Obama's request to provide funding and authorization to train and arm Syrian rebels to fight ISIS. The House passed the measure yesterday with wide bipartisan support, even though many of the president's Democratic allies voted against it. Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor and correspondent, is with us now with more. And Ron, it's unusual to have so many Republicans voting with the president's party on this, but what's expected to happen in the Senate vote today?
The Senate is expected to vote later this afternoon, and we're expecting something similar to what we saw in the House. They are expected to approve the continuing resolution with this authority in it. Now, bear in mind, in the Senate, it is a package. The authority to continue with this training and equipping of the Syrians that we approve of to fight ISIS, that is a part of the continuing resolution, which is a $1 trillion spending bill to fund the entire federal government. So it's highly unlikely the Senate is going to put the brakes on that, or we would have a government shutdown crisis again. So we don't know what the margin will be, but we expect the Senate to approve.
And here we are 46 days before the midterm elections. How is that playing into how members are voting?
Members are always thinking about the next election, and members are always thinking about what the people back home are thinking, even if they're only looking at polls as opposed to worrying about voters going to the polls. So, of course, it plays in, and especially if you're one of those Democrats running for re-election in the Senate who came in with Barack Obama in 2008, and you're hoping to be re-elected now 6 years later at a time when he is considerably less the phenomenon that he was in 2008. And we're talking here about Mark Begich in Alaska, Kay Hagan in North Carolina, Mary Landrieu, Louisiana, and so forth. Some of these people are very close in the polls to extinction in November. And so this vote and every vote they take has to be seen in that context.
Are these people likely to vote against what the president wants?
It's not clear. I think there are going to be some of them who vote no because they probably will be able to vote no. And we should be clear that in the House vote as well, there were a number of people who did not want to vote for this authorization, who had been burned on Iraq before. Iraq, of course, is where a lot of this fighting against ISIS is going on, even if they're a Syrian-based terrorist group. And they don't want to have another vote for another war on their record. At the same time, while they don't want to vote for it, many of them think it needs to happen and that it will have to happen, and they know that it will happen, and so they get to cast a vote against it, but also understand that in the end it's going to take place. Yes.
Yeah. And as we said, this is part of a much bigger spending bill. What else is in it?
This includes everything that the federal government does that's considered discretionary spending. If it's not Medicare or Social Security or something else that's mandated, it's in this CR. This continuing resolution is the government going forward, and it's going to last into December.
Now, December, I'm glad you brought that up, because there has been a lot of talk that this is just setting up a larger vote on authorization for December after the election, because right now the president is relying heavily on a 2001 authorization for the use of military force, which specifically authorizes force against those responsible for the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
That's right. And it's against terrorism, terrorists, and it's a little general. And obviously, an awful lot of people would like to have a more serious debate, a more serious discussion about what exactly we're being hauled back into Iraq and Syria to do. What exactly is that going to consist of? They would like to have that full debate. They would like that to be something other than a debate that is colored by the need to fund the entire federal government. But we may be back in somewhat similar ground when we get back here in December, and a lot of people are upset about that. We'll see exactly what they decide to do.
Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Early today, Arizona Cardinals running back Jonathan Dwyer was released from jail after his arrest last night on charges he assaulted his wife and his 18-month-old child back in July. He's accused of throwing his shoe at the child. Police began investigating after a report on the abuse was made last week. Yesterday, the Cardinals deactivated Dwyer from the team. He's the fifth NFL player in the headlines for abuse, and those headlines have brought attention to another case. Alabama's two state senators, both Republicans, are now joining calls for the federal judge Mark Fuller to resign over charges of abusing his wife. Last month, Kelly Fuller called 911 for help. This is a portion of the call and a warning. It is disturbing.
I hate you.
Ready, EMS, the address of your emergency.
Kelly. Okay. She needs an ambulance. I'm sending the police. They're in a domestic fight now at the Ritz-Carlton.
A terrible sound. Mary Ordonoff-Troyan reports for the Montgomery Advertiser and USA Today. And Mary, this happened back in August. They were in a hotel room. Judge Fuller does not deny it and has agreed to a plea deal. So what are the terms?
He agreed to enter into a pretrial diversion program, which includes some counseling. And assuming he completes that and the judge accepts his completion, he has his record expunged and presumably could return to the bench.
And this has been going on for several weeks, but we read that the charges against him might disappear if he reports back that he's gone through the terms of the deal.
Correct. Yes. It involved some domestic abuse counseling and an alcohol and drug assessment.
Yeah. Well, this judge was appointed by George W. Bush yesterday. The Republican Richard Shelby called on him to resign. How important was that? AL.com's Charles Dean said this was the proverbial 500-pound gorilla speaking.
Yes, I saw Chuck wrote that. That's pretty accurate. I would back up and say that the first member of Congress that I'm aware of to say anything at all about Judge Fuller's case was Congresswoman Terry Sewell. She's a Democrat, and she represents part of Montgomery. She tweeted last week that she thought Fuller should resign. And then Tuesday, the other female member of the Alabama delegation, a Republican congresswoman from Montgomery, Martha Roby, issued a statement. And she didn't call for his resignation, but she did say that this was a very serious issue and that she would be watching the disciplinary process closely. And she mentioned that impeachment would be possible. And that was Tuesday. And then yesterday, Senator Shelby weighed in, which was very significant. He's the senior senator. He confirmed, you know, Judge Fuller when George President Bush first nominated him in 2002. And his views carry a lot of weight in the delegation. Senator Sessions was soon after that also calling for his resignation.
And that's Jeff Sessions. Is there a sense that the tidal wave of NFL stories crashed into this story, too, and propelled it?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think so. You know, the Ray Rice story was all over the place. And I have to say that Congresswoman Roby's statement on Tuesday was a bit of a surprise. She just issued it. We didn't know that it was something that was coming. And in her statement, she specifically talks about the Ray Rice situation, shining a light on domestic abuse and it being a serious problem that needs to be addressed. You know, the other underlying current in all of this, when I talk to the members of Congress and their staffs, is a lot of this comes down to the integrity of the judicial system. You know, constituents are concerned about whether or not the court system is fair. And if they feel like a federal judge is not going to be disciplined the way a normal person would be disciplined or prosecuted for this kind of crime, then the integrity of the process is called into question. And I think that's what motivated them.
And well, and you mentioned Representative Roby mentioning the possibility of impeachment. Representative Sewell is as well. And we're reminded that federal judges serve for life. They either step down or are impeached by Congress. And if impeached, a judge can lose his pension. Right now, Judge Fuller is still collecting his $200,000 salary. So calls for him to step down, hints that there, people might push for impeachment. What do you think is going to happen?
You're absolutely right. The discussion about impeachment indicates a couple of things. Number one, if the judiciary's own disciplinary process comes back and recommends him for impeachment, then that recommendation would eventually be transferred to the U.S. House of Representatives, which would start the process. Obviously, it looks like there's some calls for him to resign before it ever gets to that point. I will say that I just saw the Associated Press just reported that Judge Fuller's attorney declined to comment on the calls for his resignation and said they were still working through the disciplinary process initiated by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Yeah. There were also reports surfacing that this isn't the first time the judge has been accused of hitting his wife. There was another wife before this one. There seems to be a snowball here. But what is he doing meanwhile? Is he a sitting judge? What happens to his cases?
Well, the 11th Circuit took away his caseload after his arrest, and so he has not been assigned any new cases. He's not sitting on the bench, and that is part of their disciplinary process. So if the judiciary system comes back and they can either return him to the bench, they can request that he resign. There's a lot of other disciplinary options that they have.
Yeah. Well, his lawyer has also said in the past that treatment and counseling is standard procedure in plea deals after a first-time domestic violence charge. But again, as we said, some reports surfaced about a potential other charge. In the meantime, what has Judge Fuller said about this incident?
We haven't heard from Judge Fuller. I did talk to Senator Shelby yesterday, and Senator Shelby told me that he called Judge Fuller and gave him a heads up that he was going to be calling for his resignation publicly. Now, I don't know what happened. I don't know Judge Fuller's side of that conversation. All I know is that Senator Shelby initiated that call and told me that he was not going to wait for a possible impeachment, that he thought Judge Fuller should step aside before it got to that point.
No. That's Mary Orndorff-Troyan. She reports for the Montgomery Advertiser in Alabama, also for USA Today, talking about the case of Judge Fuller in Alabama. Sound has surfaced of an incident in August in which he repeatedly struck his wife as she called for help from a hotel room. According to some police reports, she was confronting him about perhaps an extramarital affair. And now there are calls for him to either step down from his judgeship or perhaps look at impeachment down the road. Mary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get to the Here and Now DJ sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Daryl Brogdon hosts the Retro Cocktail Hour, which is produced at Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence, Kansas. Daryl, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. Good to be here.
And what is the Retro Cocktail Hour exactly?
I get asked that question all the time, and I don't have a satisfactory answer. I like to say that on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we play space-age pop and incredibly strange music. That covers quite a lot of musical territory.
That's a pretty good description. And you play a lot of new groups making this music. We're going to hear some of them in a minute. But first, I want to get to the late American composer and musician Les Baxter and his orchestra. Here is Simba. And this, by the way, is a style called exotica, which was very popular in the 50s and 60s.
It's true. Exotica is kind of an ersatz music. Its inspiration comes from Polynesia, from South America, from tribal Africa, but it's refracted through kind of a Hollywood prism. It's not authentic folk music. It's more translated through the Hollywood studios.
And I sort of feel like I'm watching an Indiana Jones movie there. But what do you hear there? What do you love about Simba?
Well, what's great about Simba and much of the music of Les Baxter, who really is the father of exotica, he did most of his greatest work at Capitol Records in the 1950s, where he was sort of an in-house arranger, composer, conductor. And he had the tremendous resources of Capitol Records at his disposal, and he did a number of these exotica records, which are like soundtracks to Tarzan movies you've never seen. It has a kind of a jungle flavor, kind of a tropical flavor. It's not the real thing, but it's close, and it takes you to exciting places.
It does, and here's another one from decades ago. This is the Red Calendar Sextet. This is Voodoo. I definitely feel like I'm in a retro cocktail hour, minus the cocktail here. What do you think made this catch on in the 50s and 60s?
Well, this was a jukebox single that Red Calendar made in the 50s. And I love these. This is a type of music I really love because it's kind of a mid-air collision between several different things. I mean, there's kind of an Afro-Cuban flavor to it, but there's a little R&B mixed in. You know, on the surface of it, you would think maybe that's kind of a crazy combination, but somehow it's just great, silly fun, and I love those kind of combinations.
Well, let's fast forward to today, because there are new groups that are making this kind of music, and let's hear now Creepsotica, and this is the song Bali High Bassa. Tell us about Creepsotica.
Well, Creepsotica is actually the alter ego of another band, a rock band called the Creepy Creeps. And what they've done here is they've taken some elements of Exotica music, but they've folded into it other things like surf rock. You know, there's a twangy surf guitar there, and they like to call this music Haunted Bossa Nova. It's perfect for Halloween. If you want to have an exotic Halloween, you can't go wrong with Creepsotica.
And when you say surf rock, the first thing that comes to mind is the Beach Boys, but this is very different, obviously.
Well, when I say surf rock, I'm talking about bands like Dick Dale or Davy Allen and the Arrows, you know, these really guitar-fueled bands, instrumental bands in the late 50s, early 60s. They were, at the same time, the Beach Boys were happening, but mostly instrumental music.
Well, let's go now to a group from Tampa, Florida. This is Stolen Idols. The song is On Tonga Shores. Is this the kind of thing that you would listen to not just at a cocktail hour, but in your drive to work? Or what about you? When do you listen to this?
I listen to this music 24/7, Jeremy. I don't listen to anything else. But the thing about it is now, the show that I do encompasses a lot of different types of music. Exotica is a big, big part of it, but there's others too. There's what we like to call private eye jazz, which is sort of a fake jazz that accompanied a lot of private eye TV shows in the late 50s and early 60s. There's a type of music that's called Now Sound, which is kind of a style from the early 1960s, a lot of instrumental pop that was the record companies were making quite a bit of in those days.
Well, you also wanted us to hear this Swedish group that's making Exotica. This is Ixtawela and Colors of Hawaii Tiki. Is that a xylophone?
That's a vibraphone.
A vibraphone, okay.
This is the classic instrumentation for an Exotica band, and I got a chance to meet these guys in California last month, and they've not only used the classic Exotica instrumentation, but on some of their stuff you'll also hear tropical bird calls, which is the other element of Exotica music of the 1950s.
Well, and I sort of wonder, if you've got tropical bird calls in there now, did they train these tropical birds to go live on stage when these bands perform?
Actually, no. Usually it fell to the percussionist. In the Martin Denny band, for example, Augie Colon was the percussionist, and he could imitate all these birds.
Really?
And his son, Lopaka Colon, who plays with another band called the Waitiki Seven, does the same thing today. Yeah, it's amazing to watch.
Daryl Brogdon hosts the Retro Cocktail Hour out of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence, Kansas. And Daryl, thank you so much.
Jeremy, thank you. Good to talk to you.
And Robin, are you ready for maybe a mojito or a caipirinha? Can I fix
you already
you something?
Had three. Just in the last 10 minutes.
You can hear all of our DJ session picks. Maybe you can even get a cocktail recipe at our website, hereandnow.org. But you can also get it on our Spotify playlist. Go to Spotify and search for NPR's Here and Now. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.